Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All righty. Nashville, me, I see we were talking. See, that's what radio people, ex-people that, you know, used to be chatty in the business. And, you know, me and Tom were just talking, yeah, we lost track of time. So Tom is autographing my book.
That's awesome.
As he gets ready to go out to the
book, wherever they have family reunions.
I know it. Thank you, Tom. And you definitely be listening to the podcast because it'll be on there, okay?
Thanks, man.
All right. See, so for when you have relatives come this holiday,
yeah,
get the book.
Yeah.
Then you can take them to all these places.
Where's it going, Nashville?
Yeah. Especially if they get hungry.
Oh, yeah.
I got some hookups coming. I'm getting ready to go to this Peanuts.
Okay.
And I'm going to take that walking tour with the restaurants. And because, you know, we've eaten it. Me and you have gone to a couple of these places and had lunch or something and been there for meetings or whatever. But it's all good. I can tell you that right now. So this going to the house. That's the house book right there. When my people come to see me, they can. I'll give them the list of here we're going to go. This is what we're going to do. And they like new and different stuff when they come to visit here in Nashville. So now I'll be ready for all of that. And again, you know, be sure to pick up his book, buy it directly from him. You know, these authors, Amazon's a billionaire. Go on and buy it directly from the author so they can reap the benefits of the book and the website. Let's see, when I had it here 1 second ago, I'll find it in a minute so you can go there and find his book and get it directly from him. So when you have your relatives and people come, you got some place to take them to go that are the true essence of this city. You know, a lot of newbie stuff here. People don't know we, you know, have culture and history in the city because everything, you know, is getting bulldozed and excavated and changed. And it looks like there was no established Nashville. But Lord knows it was. Now, I saw this. I want to mention this right quick. And say that I think this professor is just really an incredibly wonderful person. There was a story in today's news about a Tennessee State University educator who has successfully worked to have a historical marker put up recognizing the Nashville slave market. The reason why a lot of people don't know about, there's nothing in, hardly anything here. We don't have a museum. We don't have this. We don't have that. That's why people drive by stuff like Fort Negley and all these other places. Because it's like, you know, don't hide it. Everybody, you know, there's some history here. You know, straight up. The school says the marker identifies an area that was the center of slave trade in Nashville before the Civil War and second largest slave port in the entire state. Second, that means a lot of slave traffic went through there. Associate History Professor LaRotha Williams is certainly to be commended for this fine work. She talked about the slaves and where the marker was erected, and saying that we acknowledge your pain, we recognize your strength, and honor your sacrifice. And she said the idea for the marker came from one of his classmates, and where students wanted to know why there wasn't some type of memorial for slaves. Good question, students. Way to go. I'll be asking a whole lot of stuff about that here. I don't get it. The university says Williams wrote a letter, and a very effective proposal was what it was, with the help of the students and community members. And the Tennessee Historical Commission approved the marker in June. So that is way, way, way cool. And congratulations to Professor Williams at Tennessee State University as Associate History Professor. And the children were not asleep or unconscious on that one. They had simply asked the question, and, you know, which is so, like, duh. And so we'll have to see. Anyway, we have, did you feel the earthquake early this morning?
I didn't.
I didn't either. I slept right through it. But actually, it was nowhere near us. It was in Decatur, Tennessee, east. Engineers are inspecting the Watts Bar nuclear plant in Tennessee as a precaution after a magnitude 4.4 earthquake struck nearby. So people don't think that our state is immune from earthquakes. Apparently not. The U.S. Geological Survey says the earthquake struck eastern Tennessee and could be felt all the way in Atlanta.
Wow.
Well, I know. A lot of shaking going on. The light earthquake happened early this morning at about 4:14 a.m., about 7 miles northeast of Decatur, Tennessee. Not Decatur, Georgia, but Decatur, Tennessee. About 13 minutes later, a 3.3 magnitude aftershock struck. The Tennessee Valley Authority says the nuclear power plant didn't appear to be affected and was continuing to operate safely. According to the USGS, the eastern Tennessee seismic zone is one of the most active earthquake areas in the southeast. The zone extends across part of Tennessee, Georgia, and Alabama, and there did not appear to be anyone injured after this these little minor little earthquakes that we had in the eastern part of the state. So, you know, I had seen something that came across my desk. When was this? Probably in the last 6 months or so, about earthquakes and this part of the country and, you know, the probabilities and different things of that nature. And it was talking more about west, as in close to the New Madrid Fault and all that, like Missouri and all that. Didn't really mention east. And so this one here, this this is came out.
No, you don't.
No, you do not. And it just shows who's in charge and who isn't.
Yeah.
That is a fact. Anyway, we have. I saw you got your autograph book, didn't you?
Yeah, right before yesterday.
Yeah, because I saw. I know that. Well, we was talking about that food, and then I saw your eyes rolling back in your head.
Yeah, there's a few places I might. I've been in some of those areas.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I didn't know that was over there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there were some places that I had never been. In addition to, you know, some of the ones that I've been to, there's a bunch of them I hadn't been to.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes because it looks like a hole in the wall doesn't necessarily mean that there's not some good grub in there. Okay, that's out. So you just always can't go by the looks for sure. Anyway, what's going on with the world of... I shouldn't even get you started talking about politics today.
It's not even enough time.
I know. I'm like, I'm looking at the clock saying, no, we can't even get up on that one because there's just not enough. There is a lot.
An indictment.
Yeah. An investigation, an indictment. Craziness. Absolute insanity.
Somebody's lawyer's going to jail.
It's a lot.
National Enquirer's flipped on
It's
Trump.
A lot. It's a yeah. lot. Yeah. This.
But everyone still believes he had done anything wrong.
Well, let them believe it. That's fine. Let them I am.
He had nothing to do with anything.
I am so not even caring anymore if those people want to drink from that cup, that well. That is, you know, if that's what they want, let them have it. Let them have it.
Manager, folks in his campaign, 16, 17 people. I mean, he didn't know. How could he know?
I see. And the people have, they should have stopped asking the question now. They don't understand why the faithful people are still faithful, because there is no explanation.
That's a good one there.
Yeah, it just is what it is. And maybe once you you find some people that just cannot ever admit they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of them, obviously. But, yes, our news headlines have been popping all day long, and so is everybody else's. And we'll be watching. It's like you don't feel like you can ever turn the news off or the information off, because there's absolutely no telling as the world turns. But I do want to say, I don't care what people say about Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah,
if I go to a night fight or anything else, I'm taking Nancy.
She's no joke.
No, baby, I'm taking her. Oh, I mean, that lady knows how to boom, 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 get the job done. Don't talk about her if you want to. But when I need some help on my team, I'm taking Nessie. Yes. Now that's how you touche, boom, 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 bam. And I don't even have to look at you. I was like, you are too cold, baby. Now that's boss with the sauce. Anyway, let's take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay is brought to you by Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Dependable and knowledgeable agent, seeks customers looking for protection and long-term relationships. Look no further than Terry W. Jones, independent agent, State Farm Insurance. Having one special person for your car, home, and life insurance lets you get down to business with the rest of your life. You can stop by the offices of Terry W. Jones at 545 Mainstream Drive, Suite 104 in Metro Center, or call 615-256-6066 or by email at myagent@terrywjones.net.
Good afternoon. It's still limping along a bit there as you approach the intersection of Gallatin Pike and Conference Drive in Madison from that earlier crash. Just heavy on the Woodland Street Bridge. Just trying to get out of downtown in general here on I-24 by Shelby, especially eastbound here at Shelby. It's really busy to the south now as you make your way 65 back towards Brentwood and Franklin. This traffic report is brought to you by Float Nashville. That number is 567-7222 at floatnashville.com. I'm Commander Chuck with your on-time traffic.
Support for What's the 411 is being brought to you by Integrity Dental Care. Are you happy with your smile? Are you starting to see bad results from smoking, drinking, bad foods, or soft drinks? Integrity Dental Care would love to help you get your smile back. We do general checkups, cleanings, whitening, and take care of cavities. Consultations are free because Dr. Jacqueline Mitchell wants you to leave better than you came. At Integrity Dental Care, we treat you with integrity and not as a number. All insurances are accepted, including 10 care and cover kids. We're located at Southern Hills Hospital, Suite 314, Building C, and can be reached at 615-445-8700 or online at integritycares.com. Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810. 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All righty, Nashville. Sharon Kay is all in the house and mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And it is always good to welcome fresh new books and authors and guests to the show. And I'm very happy to have with me today Dr. Felicia Kornblau. Is it blue or blah?
It's blue.
I knew it was blue. I said, don't say blah, say blue. Dr. Kornblau is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her book, The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics, and Poverty in Modern America, is also available from the same publishing company press that her latest co-authors, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. How are you today?
I'm great, and I'm so glad that you are interested in talking about these issues. They're kind of tough issues.
Well, they are, but, you know, I am a person who's a community advocate style of person. So I am not scared.
What did he use? The W word? The welfare word?
Right. I at one point in my time and through my career and professional life, I was on it for a minute. And it was a hot minute when I needed it. And I got off of it as quick as possible. So, because it wasn't enough. And so I, and welfare is not what, you know, there's a lot to say on this subject. So I want to tell you, first I want to quickly, is Vermont as cold as I think it is right about this time of year?
It's so cold. It's so cold. I was coming home and it was about 12 degrees.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, because immediately icicles formed on my brain when I was thinking about Vermont. I bet it's cold there.
Warm hearts, though.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Dr. Kornblau, let me get a little bit of history on you and, you know, find out about, because I know you've been in academia for a while and a research and et cetera. But how long have you studied on this particular topic?
I've been teaching for 18 years full-time and doing history and women's studies, gender studies work. I'm kind of at the intersection of the two. But before that, I was an advocate. I was a child advocate when I kind of was a child, like in high school. I did advocacy work for kids like me and also kids not like me, kids in foster care and, you know, in other kinds of situations. And then I worked for a while in Washington. I worked for a committee that was eliminated by the Republicans when they took over Congress, but it used to be called the Committee on Children, Youth, and Families. You know, we were all about children's advocacy and women's advocacy, poverty, and a lot of other issues that we took on. And I worked for a couple of think tanks before I went back to graduate school and became a historian. So I've been doing this kind of work in one way or another, you know, from one location or another for about 25 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, see, I know it's all in your blood then. You know, it's going to be a good conversation.
Okay.
Now, you know, I've got to tell you, Dr. Kornblau, that the intersection that you discuss in your book and the context of it, gender, race, poverty, and inequality are just about at the intersection of everything in this country. And, you know, for people to not realize that, they are totally asleep at the wheel. How much time do you have to spend, and advocates and professionals like you, convincing people that there is such a thing as inequality in or issues involving poverty, race, and gender in most of the issues that America has to deal with?
Yeah, that's a really good good question, a good way to come at it. One of the things that I wanted to do in this book and that my co-author, Gwendolyn Mick, wanted to do was to, first of all, to speak to people who get part of it, but not all of it, right? So we have good friends who call themselves feminists. A lot of academics call themselves feminists who teach in women's studies and gender studies or who are out working, you know, with the different advocacy organizations. And so they get part of the picture, but they may not get the whole picture. They may not really understand that, for example, you know, when they talk about, I don't know, everybody needing to have access to work, you know, that's really important. It's important for us to have access to work and to be treated fairly when we're at work and not to have all the sexual harassment and all that stuff. But there are also people whose primary work is taking care of their kids or taking care of their elders or, you know, a disabled family member or somebody like that. And there are people who suffer discrimination that, you know, if you're white and you're well educated, you just might not really get your head around. And so we're trying to speak to people who, for example, get that there's a sexual dimension or a gender dimension to the story, but who don't understand that whatever they see in terms of the gender dimension, it is different and worse if you're talking about people who are black and female, or a stereotype about people who are black and female. And even people who might get it about, you know, what it's like if you're black and female might not get it about what it's like if you're black and female and poor, you know? So we want to sort of acknowledge where people are at and say, yeah, it's great that you understand part of the puzzle, and now we want you to understand these other layers that are also in there. And I think that's a conversation we can have. You know, we can persuade folks. Like my state, this is where Bernie Sanders comes from, where I live. And there are lots of people, you know, people of European descent who consider themselves progressives and stuff. And we want to start with their progressivism, but then say, look, you know, you have to understand how it impacts people in a particular way. And that your general progressivism is not really going to be enough to reach the problem.
And so have you discovered, are you finding that a lot of these problems were never fixed or addressed and therefore perpetuated to the level they are now?
Well, I think it's two things. You know, in the old days, the poverty programs, even the ones that were created in the 1930s, under the Democratic New Deal, which was a time of, you know, great liberalism for America, and then in the 1960s under the War on Poverty, like those programs were okay, but they never fully did the job.
Okay,
right? Like as you said, welfare, even the old welfare program from the 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s, right? It was hard to get benefits. It was hard to keep your benefits. The benefits were too low, right? All that stuff. So we want to acknowledge that, but also say in the middle 1990s, when Bill Clinton was in the White House and the Republicans had taken both houses of Congress for the first time in like two generations, that what they created was a reform of the welfare policy, which made it much, much worse. And it made it much harder for people to get the benefits, for people to keep the benefits, right? For people to hold their families together, right, and to pay their bills. So, you know, sure, I want to acknowledge that it was never great, and we never really did the job. We never really completed the job of eliminating poverty, right, alleviating poverty. But also that both sides of the aisle, some Democrats and almost all Republicans, collaborated in the 1990s, and they made it that much worse.
Well, they demonized women.
Absolutely.
And minorities, and had these outlandish political ads of welfare queens and people going and getting lobsters with their stamps and, you know, all kind of just utterly insane stuff. And that stuff stuck, and they're still using it now.
Right.
They're still using it now. And the irony to me is we're worrying about somebody that gets a check for $50 and we have the $50 million worth of crookedness right around the corner. I mean, our focus is on the wrong thing. I mean, to me, I was anxious to have this chat with you. In chapter one, on page three in particular, you talk about the debate from the 1996 welfare law in this section on racist myths and misogynist stereotypes, the preference to the new welfare law. Give us the overview on that, please.
Yeah, so the law from the 1990s was what they called a reform of the old welfare program, and they gave it a new name and really recast it. So in the old days, at least the idea was that the program was supposed to take care of mothers and children, you know, who had gotten into a bad position for whatever reason, like maybe an abusive boyfriend or husband, or, you know, something happened and people wound up very poor and needing the help, right? So, and it used to be that that help was provided on what they call an entitlement basis, meaning if you qualified by the federal rules and by the rules of your own state, that you were guaranteed that you could get the help. And what they did in 1996 is they changed the name of the program and the idea of the program to temporary assistance to needy families. And it was supposed to be temporary all the way through, no longer an entitlement. So if your state, you know, ran out of money, then you were just out of luck. Yeah. And also, right, and also there was a maximum national limit of 5 years for your whole lifetime that you could possibly get benefits. And many states have reduced that even further. And the federal government said it was okay for them to reduce it even further. So, you know, let's say you have young children and you're trying to get them into full day school or something. If you have more than one kid, you know, and if you've had a history of whatever, violence, abuse, or some kind of extreme thing, whatever, you live in an area of the country where there's like hyper unemployment, you know, it might take you 5 years to get on your feet, or it might take you 3 years to get on your feet, and your state might have a cutoff that's less than that. So that was the big change, that it became temporary and not an entitlement anymore. And then they also, you know, had all kinds of other methods for kind of siphoning money away from the program so that the states are allowed to use some of the money that should be going to women and children for other purposes, including for what they call marriage promotion programs, which don't give anybody money, but they give people a lot of rhetoric about how they should go get married. And I don't see where that really helps people. You know, whereas we know that if mothers have more money in their pockets, more money in the bank, they spend it on their kids have better health, they have better health. You know, we have good evidence that when people have a little bit more money and they're poor, they spend it on the right things, and the outcomes are better. But the federal government wasn't really interested in that. They were building on those kinds of racist and anti-woman, anti-mother stereotypes, so they went in the other direction.
Now, on page 15, you talk about legislative inequality. So they did that, they legislated it by, to me, the imaging that was wrapped around it, the negative stereotypes, excuse me, and the images that were wrapped around it, and then wrote laws to end entitlements, which you just talked about. Is that what you're talking about here in this section on legislating inequality?
Yes, very much so. And it also kind of locks in some older patterns of inequality. You know, when this program was created in the 1930s, it was bigger and it was kind of uncontroversial. But then over the years, women who are married to guys who are, you know, full-time employed in the labor force have gotten other forms of assistance, like through Social Security. So if you're married to somebody who has, you know, is in the Social Security system and they have a full-time job and so on, then you never wind up in this program. And it just happens, and I don't think it's by accident, that, you know, the people who are in the Social Security system tend more, you know, they're more likely to be white, they're more likely to be from kind of stable, in middle class or upper working class kinds of backgrounds, you know. So there are certain patterns of inequality that are just built into the whole structure of the system.
Yeah.
And we've locked those in and essentially said to people who are, you know, who are needing this kind of assistance, you know, if you need the help, it might be there, but it really might not be there.
Yeah.
You know, kind of pulling the rug out from under people.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on page 17, you say the most famous promise of the 1990s welfare reformers was that the new policy would end welfare as we know it. Boy, that's said and oversaid a million times. By moving recipients from welfare to work. Welfare to work, that's their slogan. Welfare to work. TANF's work provisions teach the work ethic by requiring labor market engagement, but do little to assure recipients that compliance will win them an economic security. Now, is that welfare to work system working?
No, it's not. And this is one of the things that I think people really need to think about. We, as a society, we believe that people should take care of themselves, and I believe in that too. And we believe we're a pretty generous country in some ways. We generally believe that if we're going to ask that of people, that people have to have opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of talk when this welfare reform was passed in the 1990s about how we were going to give people kind of an off-ramp from welfare, give them some tools, and then would expect them to work. And it sounds good, except that off-ramp was never really provided.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, what happened was that the federal government cut the amount of education that they allowed people to go get while receiving this kind of support. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, people who were getting public assistance were able to go back to school, and there were community college programs opening up all over the country, right, to help them out. And that was considered, quote-unquote, work, because people were educating themselves full-time in order to get better jobs, right? So that was considered a legitimate kind of work or a legitimate effort for people to make. But then in the middle 90s, there was the same talk about giving people opportunities, but they actually pulled back.
Mm-hmm.
And they no longer let people go do those good degree programs in the community colleges. They didn't let people go to four-year colleges, even if they were qualified to go to four-year colleges. You know, they didn't let people count their work study that they were doing when they were in school as part of their work requirement. So it was really, it was the rhetoric and the reality were just going in two different directions.
And talk about discouraging to people. You know, if you're down,
me
just go ahead and throw another kick on you. And, you know.
Right, and no child care.
Yeah.
No promise of child care. There was a little more money for child care.
Right.
But child care is very expensive, and
yes,
the costs go up all the time. You
yes
know, especially if you pay the people who are providing the child care, you know, who are working in the center adequately. And it was never a match. There was never a real guarantee to people that the child care would be there, that it would be safe, that it would be reliable, accessible. It was never provided.
Well, when we come back from the break, we're going to go deeper into this book to talk about the issues as they are. And I know some of you all listening out there are like, get them queens off the couch and get a job. I mean, I already know that's how, you know, a lot of folks think. But it's not these luxury items that you've been led to believe at all. My guest is Dr. Felicia Kornbluh. She's an associate professor of history and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the University of Vermont. She is co-author of the new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, Welfare Reform, rather, in Feminist Perspective. Let's take a time out, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Want to give your opinion today? The phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810.
Support for What's the 411 is being brought to you by Integrity Dental Care. Are you happy with your smile? Are you starting to see bad results from smoking, drinking, bad foods, or soft drinks? Integrity Dental Care would love to help you get your smile back. We do general checkups, cleanings, whitening, and take care of cavities. Consultations are free because Dr. Jacqueline Mitchell wants you to leave better than you came. At Integrity Dental Care, we treat you with integrity and not as a number. All insurances are accepted, including 10 care and cover kids. We're located at Southern Hills Hospital, Suite 314, Building C, and can be reached at 615-445-8700 or online at integritycares.com.
Well, good afternoon. Several wrecks out here. One being cleared on the west side. They're 40 westbound at Whitebridge Pike. Checking a crash 65 northbound near Harding Place. Heaviest flow of traffic's going southbound back into Brentwood on 65. Citgo at Harding Place was tied up a few minutes ago, and so was Cloverland at OHB. They're in Brentwood on a two-car collision. This traffic report is brought to you by Float Nashville at 567-7222. They're online at floatnashville.com. I'm Commander Chuck with your on-time traffic.
It's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.
Hello, Nashville. Coming up Sunday morning from 7 to 9, Jesus is the reason for the season. What Christmas means to us, it's the 411 show's annual Christmas special program.
That's What's the 411 with Sharon Kay, twice a week, every Sunday morning from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. right here on Jazzy 88 WFSK.
This week's Jazzy 88 Artist of the Week is singer, musician, and composer Johnny Britt. His latest album is entitled Christmas Time of the Year. Be sure not to miss the Jazzy 88 Artist of the Week. That's on Thursdays from noon to 1. You hear prime cuts from the brand new release and have a chance to win some new music right here on WFSK with the Jazzy 88 Artist of the Week.
Christmas is the time of the year when everybody comes to town.
Keep up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
Alrighty, Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK Historic Fisk University. And in your course of your life, you have ups and downs and ins and outs. And in today's world, if you do, you're almost on your own. And you just don't know if you're family and friends or whatever the case may be, but that we have no safety net. And this to me is discussing a safety net issue in our country. Dr. Felicia Kornbluh is my guest, and she is co-author of Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspective. Is this, Dr. Kornbluh, I'm going to go back into talking about the book, but as you have done the research, is this a couple of decades worth of consistent reform that, after all this, with these different administrations and these laws and et cetera, I feel like some stuff in our country is never going to get fixed. And it's like because we just swirl around in the same swirl and never move to solutions. Is this one of those issues that is not ever going to have a solution, in your opinion?
I hope that's not the way it goes. One of the things that we want to argue in this book is that things did change in the 1990s, and they changed for the worse But because we have the memory of what it was like before then, we know that we can change it back, right? And because we have the memory of some of the people who stood up and who dissented, even Democrats who said to their own Democratic president in the 1990s, you know, don't sign this bill. This is going to leave, you know, a group of our constituents, a group of Americans out in the cold.
Right.
This is going to be bad, right? We know that those people existed. And so now when we're looking at how to find our way back, I think we can build on their example, we can stand on their shoulders a little bit, you know. And I think we're pretty hard in the book on President Obama because we see, you know, him continuing the pattern from the 1990s. But there were some things in the Obama years. You know, I think Obama was treading very lightly. He was very careful about a lot of issues because of the environment he was in. But he did try, for example, to ease up on some of the restrictions on the states and wanted to let the states who are implementing these programs, these anti-poverty programs, have more flexibility so that, for example, you know, if your state was having high poverty, high unemployment, and it was difficult for people to find jobs, that you could loosen up and have more flexibility in the kind of work that you would require of people, or the percentage of people that you would demand would be out there in the waged workforce, right? And you could let more, you know, more people raise their own kids or take care of their elderly parents or whatever. And that's the kind of thing. It was just like dipping a little toe in the water to try and see whether we could make it a little, you know, make it a little better. And the Republicans hammered him and, you know, and distorted the policy that he was trying to implement and everything. But I think that was one effort to kind of, you know, throw the hat over the wall and see what happens. And I think Democrats now, you know, there's sort of an identity crisis going on in the Democratic Party. And I think that as part of that identity crisis, people can revisit these issues. And I think they will. I really think they will.
You think they're strong? They'll be stronger in them now because so many women for the first time will be in Congress?
I think that that might make a difference. I think it might make a difference. And also, it's women, and there's a progressive caucus, in part because of my senator, Mr. Sanders, but also because of, you know, movements on the ground, the Women's March, Black Lives Matter. You know, they've really, people have worked hard on the outside, but also on the inside, to change what's going on in Congress and inside the Democratic Party. And I think they've been looking at a lot of the mistakes that were made in the 1990s, like about building too many prisons and, you know, sort of overdoing the tough on crime thing. And I think that it's time for them to also revisit this issue, the issue of welfare and how we take care of mothers and children in particular who get into a bad financial situation. So that's what I'm hoping for. And I also, I work for that myself, you know, as an advocate in my own state. And when I have a chance to, I work for it on the national level too.
Okay. All right. Now, I knew I spotted an advocate on here. I knew it. I said, she knows how to march and wave the flag and everything. I can already tell and do the attend the meetings. I got you. Now, politics and poverty are woven, of course, in our American history. As the system was developed up through the current administration, which presidents and administrations have been the absolute worst for people who were requiring or were trying to get assistance, and also in that assistance, cash assistance? But what about the SNAP program and programs of that nature?
Well, you could definitely make an argument that the current president is about as bad as we get, you know, and it's because, and I think it's, you know, it's the end of this long history, but what we see today is that, you know, it's not just the moms and the kids who are getting trashed. You know, that's what happened in the 1990s, is that low-income women and their children were essentially told, you know, you don't matter, and we're going to take away your safety net. But now it's kind of, it's, you were suggesting, it's kind of everything. So SNAP or food stamps, which doesn't provide any cash. It just gives you some access to food for yourself and your kids.
Why would that be demonized?
Well, it's all in the same bucket, and you know, I think in part because we haven't really looked at this issue, the same myths that were rolled out in the middle 1990s and applied to what we call the program we call welfare, those same myths are still kind of running amok. And if the Democrats, the progressives, the feminists don't kind of gather them up and say, look, we made a mistake in the 1990s, we have to correct those myths, then those myths are going to continue to drive the policy. It shouldn't be controversial. It shouldn't be controversial at all. It never was before, but now suddenly they're trying to say it's all welfare, right? It's all just a kind of welfare, and they're drawing on the idea that welfare is somehow illegitimate, that welfare somehow, you know, refers to mothers who aren't doing a good job as being mothers and who aren't working hard enough, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And they're trying to apply that to disability benefits, right, and say that somehow people are getting disability benefits for the wrong reasons, you know, and they don't deserve them. They're trying to apply it to Medicaid, which is just health care. You know, there's no cash. It's just health care, and very, very many mothers and children rely on their getting their health care through the Medicaid program. They're trying to throw people off Medicaid and say you need a quote-unquote work requirement, which really is just going to make people not apply and not, you know, not get health care for themselves and their kids. So the Republican conservatives are going to keep going, you know.
And which is going to cost us more. Which is going to cost us more if, you know, folks don't have health care or can't or do nothing preventive. You know, it's really going to cost the country more.
That's right.
That is just so stupid. So where does, outside of trying to be in charge of the person at the power helm, where does all this craziness come from?
Well, I think it's particular to the politics of the moment, right? Somebody like Trump, he wants to get elected. He's looking for the main chance. He needs to demonize somebody. He's looking for an enemy because I think his kind of politics is you create an in-group and you create an out-group.
Right.
And, you know, the in-group is his guys, his people. And they feel better about themselves if they're all gathered together and they have somebody else to demonize and separate themselves from. I mean, this is what researchers have found, like with people who vote with the Tea Party or call themselves Tea Party, is that they consider themselves quote-unquote workers, even though a huge percentage of them are retired or not actually working, you know, and there's some idea that the workers are the good people and that there's some other people out there who are the non-workers, right?
Yes.
So they create that politics, and that lets somebody like Trump get elected, and that lets him do a lot of other stuff like cutting corporate taxes, cutting taxes on the wealthiest, you know, and really do a massive transfer of wealth to the wealthy.
And that's, I guess that
that's
worked
my
on,
cynical view.
Well, that same formula worked on health care. Because when people voted against their own self-interest was the stupidest thing I've ever seen. When they didn't want health care and then suddenly they started creating all these health issues. Diabetes and high blood pressure and prostate and cancer and everything started hitting them. And then suddenly, oh my God, I gotta have health care. Well, I mean, I'm like, Lord, help these people. Because the ones who, that Tea Party style mindset, they have kids and grandkids and nieces and nephews that likely are on these systems or have been.
Yes. All right, Medicaid, you know, it's health insurance that reaches a huge percentage of Americans, you know, probably 50% of the people who are in nursing homes, you know, are there because the Medicaid program is paying for them. And I don't know what, you know, families would do if that support wasn't there. Some, you know, huge percentage of people who are disabled get health care through Medicaid.
Yeah.
They get other support through other, you know, other programs. Yeah, it affects all of us.
Yeah.
So that's the way the politics are played. And I think there's something about it which is very, very new and cynical, and of our, you know, of our present time or of our modern time. And then, you know, it's old American stuff. As I teach my students, you know, we've had sexism since the beginning of this country. We've obviously had, you know, racism and certain kinds of stereotypes about race since the beginning of this country.
Yes.
So they play on that too.
Yeah. Oh, definitely on that one. Now, X, what were you going to say?
I thought this was really funny. You know, when Donald Trump got elected, they interviewed this man who he uses the Affordable Care Act, and without it, he'd die. So they asked him, well, why did you vote for Trump? And he ran on the platform of doing away with the Affordable Care Act. And the guy goes, well, nah, I don't believe they really do that. I wonder where he is now.
Well, he probably is at the doctor. I mean, you know.
No, I don't believe that.
He's probably trying to make sure his deductible has been met by the end of the year. Now, Dr. Kornblum, the latest seems to be the immigration and migration situation, and the Trump administration, or him himself, using them as the latest football that he wants to kick around.
Yeah.
So what's your take on that?
I have to say that Bill Clinton did it too. Mm-hmm. You're studying the history of the 1990s. And there was a lot in this law that we write about in Ensuring Poverty that was about stopping immigrants from getting benefits. Mm. So there was that nasty piece, even among the Democrats, even way back in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're seeing today, obviously, it's at a new extreme. Yeah. You know, it is very heightened. It's full of lies about who these folks are and, you know, what kind of threat they might pose to the rest of the country.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, it's really a crisis situation, and we need to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
But I would just also caution and say, you know, there's a lot of responsibility that could be shared between mainstream Democrats and conservative Republicans around that issue as well.
Yeah, no question about it. And I just, you know, all this stereotype stuff, it's like, oh my God, it never ends. This stuff never ends. And I just hope the day would come that people would stop, you know, because it's fear at the intersection of all these pieces that you have described in your book. Fear is at the center of all that. And that fear is what's keeping people ignorant and bound down. I'm like, man, y'all are just... But anyway, I just had to just let that off my chest, because I just get so frustrated with, we can't go further in our country, and we just keep circling back around to the same dumb stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's just...
Can I add 2 points of
sure,
optimism?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, one thing is that we may not need to persuade other people. Thank God we still have a democracy. It's mostly a democracy. And there are enough people who want to move things forward that we can do it. You know, there are a lot of people who have a lot of power, who are not stuck in those old patterns of fear. And so, you know, maybe we don't need to persuade as many people as we need to persuade. We just need to act. And I think we can. And the other thing is, you know, all the social science research says people are afraid of things when they don't know anything about them.
Truly.
You know, right, when you have a next-door neighbor who's gay or trans or whatever, then suddenly you don't have the same kinds of attitudes that you have if you don't know anybody who's gay or trans.
True.
or whatever the characteristic is, right? And ours is still a dynamic and diverse society, and the more we get to know each other, the more the fear kind of burns off.
That's true.
I really believe that.
That is absolutely true. And that's why some people do all they can to block people from leaving their particular areas and neighborhoods and don't staying segregated, so that they won't have to have that experience. And that is really sad. And I enjoy having guests like you on my show, Dr. Kornblum, and the reason why is because the bulk of talk radio is right-wing conservative stuff, and the airwaves deserve to have a different opinion on them.
Well, that's why you're important out there.
So I am glad to have had this discussion with you so people have a choice. They can go to the trough and drink something different and have a differing opinion. Thank you so very much. And I hope that your holiday season is absolutely everything that you want it to be.
You too, and thanks for having me.
Oh, wait a minute. Tell them where the book is available and how to find out more about you.
Yeah, so the book is Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, and Feminist Perspective, University of Pennsylvania Press.
Mm-hmm.
It's available through them and through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And if you want to find out about me, I tweet at VTFeminist, Vermont Feminist, and I'm at the University of Vermont. You can always find me there.
Thank you so much. And you have a good rest of the day, okay?
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye. Let me thank, again, historian and professor, Dr. Felicia Kornbluh. And she has a new co-authored a new book with Gwendolyn Mink entitled Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform, in Feminist Perspective. So we thank her so very much. Now, the 401 shows are available on podcast at SharonK's401.com. I try to get those things up there as quick as I can. So be sure to, anything you might have missed or want to go back to find out about, be sure to go up there and click on where it says podcast, and the whole bunch of them are there. You just, you know, I add more every week. So, you know, check it out. Anyway, Nashville, that is all A-L-L we have for you today. You all have the very best of the best. And don't forget who loves you.
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
You're listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay.